of at the ready. James Reese settled in behind the rifle, building his house as he had learned to do all those years ago. He was in the kill zone. He wished Freddy was with him, spotting, providing security. He thought of his men slaughtered in the mountains of Afghanistan, his brothers in arms lying dead in the darkness. He had avenged them just as he was avenging Freddy. He remembered his old sniper school partner talking him through the shot.
"Slow and steady, brother. Slow and steady."
Reese had always been the better shot, but when it came to the art and science of sniping, the spotter was the most valuable member of the team. Freddy was the spotter. That was where he excelled.
"Talk to me, brother."
Freddy beside him on a spotting scope, a building in Iraq.
"You know what to do, brother. Build that house solid. Trust the acceptable reticle movement. Breathing. It's all about that breathing and that slow trigger press to the rear. When the time is right, when you have your target."
"I'm on it, Freddy."
"I don't need to tell you, but just in case, press the trigger. Don't forget to follow through. Ride the bull, call your shot, and get ready to re-engage."
Reese gave an imperceptible nod.
"You are the best I've ever worked with,"
Freddy said.
"No one better behind the glass. Make sure you are doing this for the right reason."
Reese closed his eyes.
"What?" "The right reason. Breathe. It's time to work." "I'm gone, Reese. Your team is gone. I know what you did for Sam. He's going to be taken care of because of you. Who knows if I could have done that had I lived. You did it, brother. Joni doesn't know who deposited that money, but I do."
"Not now, Freddy."
"Reese, if you get this done, do me a favor."
"What?"
"Live."
"What?"
"Live, not in the past, not on that rooftop in Odessa, not on a mountain in Afghanistan, not in the house where your family was murdered. Live in the moment. Be present. Do it for me and all those who love you. Do it for Katie. I need to focus, find my target. Forgive."
"What are you talking about? Forgive what?"
"Forgive Nizar. Forgive yourself. Live."
Reese turned his head. Freddy was gone. Reese was not in Ramadi. He was back in Montenegro. All that was left were the rocks and trees of the Montenegrin mountains, the rotting wood, the birds, the breeze. His friend had vanished. Reese was back on mission, back where he belonged, behind the rifle. Chapter 77. Le Drian pushed himself forward, driven not just by the money, though as a mercenary that was a large part of it. He was also driven by the challenge. James Reese.
"Motherfucking James Reese. If you put this guy down, you will get a payday, and you will be the man who did what even the U.S. government couldn't pull off, and, if rumors were true, what the Russians couldn't do either."
Le Drian might even find his name in a book. Maybe he would write his own, from exile. Shit, maybe he'd write a few, like Mad Mike Hoare had done back in the day.
"Later, first kill this son of a bitch."
Le Drian stopped short. What was that? Up ahead, an unnatural shape. A pack. The Frenchman brought up the AK and slowly went to a knee. Had he the indigenous man-trackers from Africa with him, he would have flankers to signal. He was on his own now. Well, not exactly. There was another man on the mountain with a rifle hunting the former SEAL. But it was Le Drian who had found him. The Frenchman's eyes scanned ahead.
"Do not rush. Reese is a sniper. He will be taking his time. He knows we are out here, but he does not know he is being tracked. He is focused on another threat, and he thinks that my phone in the decoy is his target."
The French Foreign Legion sniper training took over as he scanned slowly for the target, for the first 5 meters, then to 10 meters, his eyes shifting back and forth in concert with the barrel of the Kalashnikov. Reese's tracks had changed. Even from a distance, Le Drian could tell that Reese had dropped his pack and crawled forward into a shooting position with just his rifle. Le Drian's heart rate increased, a cold sweat seeping through his skin. The kill was close. Just a few more yards and James Rees would be in his sights.
The fool. That's what happens when you get emotional in this business, you ended up dead. Should I shoot him from here, or get closer? Don't be an idiot. Use the AK. Shoot as soon as you... There.
A rifle. Vegetation. But no Rees. In the instant that Le Drian realized what was happening, he began to spin to his 6 o'clock, but froze when a hushed voice pierced the still, cold air.
Drop it. Fuck!
Put the rifle on the ground and turn around. Action being faster than reaction, had Le Drian been facing the other direction, he would have made a move, knowing he had a better-than-average chance of getting a shot off before his adversary. But he was not facing the sniper. He had walked right into the trap. What did he have to work with? He had information. That information was now his weapon. He owed no loyalty to Nizar. Le Drian was a mercenary. Mercenaries worked for money, and in this situation, he had something of value to sell.
Okay, Mr. Rees, I am putting it down.
He was already in the kneeling position, so the rifle did not have far to go. When it was on the ground, Le Drian slowly raised his hands above his head.
May I turn? You may.
The voice was devoid of emotion. It was coarse, rough, resolved. Le Drian swallowed and rotated around, still on his knees.
Merde.
What he saw made his eyes go wide with terror. The man before him looked like he was a part of the land, an animal, a savage. Even more disconcerting was that he appeared at peace.
Mr. Rees, I am Jean-Pierre Le Drian. I am a soldier, like you. I know who you are. You're a merc. You shot a friend of mine out of the sky. Killed her along with 128 innocent people. You're no soldier. And you? What are you? You won't be of this earth long enough to find out.
Le Drian's eyes moved to Reese's hands. Both were at his sides. One held a menacing-looking tomahawk with a protruding front spike, the likes of which Le Drian had never seen before. In the other, he held a small pistol that Le Drian recognized as an old Nagant with a suppressor.
Mr. Rees, we can make a deal, yes. I know where Nizar is. I know his plan. I can help you.
There was no flash of consideration, no moment of reflection. Rees's eyes remained cold, calculated. There was but one thing on his mind. Death.
If you kill me, Mr. Rees, your odds of taking Nizar go down dramatically. They don't.
Le Drian took a breath, coming to terms with what was going to happen. Already on his knees, he brought his hands together and began to recite the Lord's Prayer.
And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
The mercenary paused.
Amen.
When he opened his eyes, Rees was still standing there. His executioner had not moved.
Blade or bullet? Are you really going to let me choose?
No. Rees raised his pistol and put one suppressed 7.62x38R round into the Legionnaire's face. Chapter 78. The sniper continued to scan, smoothly, methodically. This part of the game was all about patience. If he heard the report of a 7.62x39, he would know that the Frenchman had found his mark. Nizar thought about killing Le Drian rather than paying him, just as he had with his mentor, the master sniper known as the Shishani. It's possible the Frenchman would anticipate that move and disappear, only to reemerge and hunt down Nizar if the payment didn't come through.
If I have him in my scope after I kill Rees, I'll take him down. If he's smart enough to disappear, he'll get his payment.
Nizar wondered if he would kill twice this day. He froze. A change. Subtle, but a change, nonetheless. Green against a rock where there had not been green an hour ago. Nizar slowly adjusted the focus in and out to burn through the vegetation with his binoculars. Hard to tell, but something was different. An elbow. The crown of a barrel. It was pointing across the valley, but not at Nizar. It was aiming directly at the dummy position Nizar had set up.
"Move fast, but not too fast, Nizar,"
he heard the Shishani caution him. At any moment, Rhys could figure out that the man in his sights was a decoy. Time became of the essence. Would Rhys rush the shot? No. He was a sniper like Nizar, a master of his craft.
"Only control what you can control, Nizar,"
he heard the Shishani advise. He pushed thoughts of the old sniper out of his mind.
"Master sniper, I outwitted you and I've outwitted James Rhys."
He thought of the millions that would soon be transferred into his account through the Montenegrin Construction Corporation, and he thought of where he would go. Argentina? Thailand? Probably Thailand. If he ever got tired of Thai girls, he could make a base in Argentina. Besides, both Thai and Russian hookers were a commodity the world over.
"Not now, Nizar. Make this shot and end it."
Behind the scope, he made his elevation adjustment and a micro-adjustment to his focus knob and parallax, slowly zooming in on the barrel and then following it back to the elbow. Rhys was still pointing at the decoy.
"Yes, adjust from here. Barrel, elbow. That means the head is right about there. And the body."
The shot took Nizar by surprise, even though the dummy location was set up for just this purpose. The bullet flew harmlessly across the valley and quite probably into the already dead man that Nizar had camouflaged behind the rifle. Nizar made a final analysis of the constantly changing environmental factors, lastly evaluating the swirling winds. He noted the leaves next to his target's position, which indicated the wind was moving left to right, closest to Rhys, where it was most likely to affect the bullet. Holding to the left for wind, Nizar took a deliberate breath, evenly exhaling until he hit the bottom of his natural respiratory pause. Then he pressed back on the trigger. Chapter 79. The shot exploded across the valley, 1,180 meters. Nizar called his impact, center. He racked the bolt on his rifle, settled back on the target, and sent a second round.
Center.
He racked the action again, adjusted to where Rhys's head would be, went through his shot sequence, and pressed the trigger again. He moved the reticle back to Rhys's center mass, cheating a bit toward the head, to put his bullet into his target's upper thorax, the heart and lungs.
Center.
Opening the bolt, he smoothly reloaded with the four bullets he had neatly arranged to his right, and prepared to re-engage. No movement. Nizar reached up to the focus dial on his scope and moved it ever so slightly back and forth in an attempt to confirm his hits.
What's that?
He moved back to the elbow that had now fallen away from the body, exposing a silver watch. Rhys wore a stainless steel Rolex. His target package had been specific. He stayed focused on the wrist and watch for 10 minutes. No movement. He moved his scope around the target area. A symmetrical shape.
A shoe?
Yes. Nizar focused in. A Salomon shoe, so popular with American special operators. He focused on the shoe for what must have been 15 minutes. Still, no movement. Nizar almost couldn't believe it. Fighting the urge a hunter has to confirm his kill, he stayed in position, switching from his scope to binoculars. Watch and boot in the same positions. He fought to control his breathing. James Rhys, dead. Money in the account. One loose end with Le Drian. Pay or kill. The choice was the Frenchman's. The sniper waited another 45 minutes. No sign of movement. No sign of life. It was time to disappear. Nizar checked that his rifle was on safe, stuffed his binoculars beneath his shirt, and pushed himself backward out of his hide sight in the side of the mountain, maneuvering into a position behind a large rock in the dead space out of sight from anyone observing him from afar. He stretched his legs and forced blood back into extremities, which had cramped up from holding position for so long. He collected himself faster than he would have thought. The implications of killing James Rees and becoming wealthy beyond his expectations warmed his chilled bones.
"Confirm the kill, get off the mountain, and then leave this life behind."
Nizar secured the Orsus T-5000 in his pack, the barrel protruding above his head. He stood, slung and adjusted the pack, then picked up the integrally suppressed Soviet Ventores rifle and began to make his way toward the dirt road where he had parked the old Land Rover.
Thailand awaits.
Chapter 80. Nizar forced himself to work his way deliberately down the mountain toward his vehicle. No trails existed in this corner of Montenegro, and the sniper was careful to take a circuitous route instead of following the tracks he had left on his way in, just in case the French mercenary had designs on taking him out. That was not likely. It was much more likely the other way around, which Nizar was sure the Frenchman recognized. To get paid, Nizar needed to live. The Frenchman would probably disappear, stay out of Nizar's sights, accept payment, and return to his beloved Africa. But this was the thinking man's game. Those who believed it was only about triggers and optics didn't last long. Just in case Le Drian had any ideas, Nizar had a contingency plan in place. The Syrian caught sight of the road about 2 kilometers from where he had parked his truck. Even though his old 1966 Series 1 Land Rover was always breaking down, the engine was still simple enough that Nizar could diagnose the issue and fix it himself. It got him where he needed to go on the rutted-out roads of the Dermator Mountain region. He paralleled the dirt road until he was almost opposite the vehicle. Once again, he exercised a sniper's patience and nestled into the brush, putting the Ventores on the ground and bringing the old Leica binoculars to his eyes. He observed the vehicle for any signs that it had been tampered with. He always left it dirty for just this purpose, easier to see handprints that didn't belong. The ground around it was absent of tracks that were not there when he left, and the surrounding hillsides were clear of any signs that there was a person or team lying in wait. This was his territory. The Montenegrin mafia saw to it that he was protected here. They were the de facto government of Montenegro, but Nizar had not lived this long by trusting those within his sphere. He continued to watch the truck and surrounding area for another hour. Satisfied all was as it should be, he worked his way down to the vehicle. He had called it. The Frenchman was nowhere to be seen. The mercenary was smarter than he looked. Nizar would not need to exercise his contingency plan after all. He opened the passenger side door of the right-side drive Land Rover and unslung his pack with the T-5000 rifle. He set it upright on the floorboards and closed the door. Looking back up at the surrounding hillsides, Ventores in hand, he walked around the front of the vehicle and opened the door. He slid the Soviet-era rifle next to his seat and was about to step in when he sensed he was not alone. He turned to his left. There, in the road, was a djinn, a supernatural creature he had long ago relegated to the trash with the rest of the Quranic teachings of his youth. Those teachings came back to him now. Standing in front of him was a ghost, an apparition, holding a Kalashnikov. Chapter 81. Nizar's disbelief quickly switched gears to calculations of time, speed, and accuracy. Sniper rifle in the passenger seat, VSS Ventores muzzle down against the far side of the driver's seat. Rees was about 10 meters away. He held the Kalashnikov, Le Drian's Kalashnikov, by its pistol grip. The rifle was slung and pointed at the ground.
Maybe there is time to go for the weapon. Is Rees a vision? How could this be?
Leaving the door open, Nizar turned to face the man he thought he had sent to the grave, a grudging sense of wonder replacing the disbelief.
You continue to prove harder to kill than one would expect, Nizar said.
Keep him standing there. There is one last option.
Who did I kill on the mountain?
Nizar asked.
I didn't miss.
Rhys let a small pack slide from his shoulder. Nizar thought of his plan, an understanding coming to him as he studied his adversary moving from his weapon to his face and then to Rhys's clothes. The clothes he had last seen on Jean-Pierre Le Drian. Rhys reached in the pack and pulled out the mercenary's head, tossing it to the dirt at Nizar's feet. The Syrian stared into the one upturned eye of the man he had hired to track down and kill the seal, who now stood before him, seemingly holding the upper hand. One of the mercenary's eyes was gone, replaced by an entry wound. The low-velocity bullet had entered through the left eye, expanded, torn through Le Drian's brain, and taken a large section of the back skull with it as it exited, giving the head a lopsided shape where it had caved in. Nizar looked back to the American.
Stall, there is one last contingency.
I warned him not to, what is the American word, underestimate you. It appears I should have taken my own advice.
Perhaps, Rhys said.
How did you fire that shot? Had you not fired, I might have given it a bit more time to confirm you were behind that, Dragunov.
Rhys reached into his pocket and pulled out a knotted ball of twine. Nizar shook his head.
And the watch?
It's on Le Drian's other arm, which is still next to my rifle. Don't worry, I'll be going back to collect it.
That Rolex was a nice touch. You got me with the watch trick. It's not personal, you know. It's business,
Nizar said, changing the direction of the conversation.
It's personal to me.
Ah, yes.
Your friend, the seal. Frederick. I read his name in the target package.
That's right. Senior Chief Frederick Strain.
Freddy.
This is his tomahawk, Rhys said, reaching behind his belt and unsheathing the ancient weapon.
I thought a fellow sniper would want to take me the same way I took your friend.
You thought wrong. Rhys pushed the Kalashnikov to his left side and dropped the Winkler into his right hand.
Is this how you killed Le Drian?
No, he got a bullet to the face. This is for you, Rhys said, stepping forward to snatch the soul of the man who had killed his friend and teammate. Nizar held up his hand, but not toward Rhys. Instead, it was toward the tree line to the east.
Before you kill me, you should remember I too am a sniper, and I too can plan for contingencies.
Nizar turned his head to the left and into the thicket just off the road. Rhys's eyes followed, right into the barrel of an AK. The man holding it knew enough to stay behind the cover of a thick tree, just the rifle and the side of his head against the stock, his right eye sighting down the irons. Even slightly obscured, Rhys recognized the face of the man from the Silver Peugeot, the man Rhys had let live. Chapter 82.
It seems as though I have outplayed you, Commander Rhys,
Nizar said, his left hand up, holding off his shooter for the time being.
You will soon join your friend Freddy. What was he doing on that roof in Odessa? It was supposed to be someone else, a Georgian, if memory serves.
He was doing his job.
Ah, yes, you Americans and your sense of duty, I've studied it. Commendable in some regards. It did make this next phase of my life possible, so perhaps I should thank you.
What part?
The part where I leave this.
Nizar moved his hands, gesturing to all around him.
Where this life becomes my past.
Rhys's face had not changed since their eyes had first met.
He has to know he's about to die,
Nizar thought.
Where is the fear? Was your plan to do this forever?
Nizar asked.
No, just until I killed you. Well, I do hate to disappoint. It seems like imperial hubris is not just an ailment of your ruling class. We are more alike than you think, Mr. Rhys.
Nizar saw the change, a flicker of recognition in Reese's eyes.
We are the same. Goodbye, Mr. Rhys. Ma'asalama, or as my former Russian employers would say, Dasvidanya.
Nizar.
Yes?
Remember what you said about contingencies? Instant fear, recognition, anger, and surprise flashed across Nizar's face as he dropped his hand and yelled,
"Kutil!"
"Shoot!" to the man behind the tree. The snap of a bullet breaking the sound barrier registered before the reverberations of the shot echoed off the canyon walls, but not before the side of Jovan Kujovic's head caved in. A pink and gray mist left hanging momentarily in the cold air as his body dropped straight to the earth. Chapter 83. Nizar jumped as the bullet snapped across the road and put his last contingency in the ground. Reese did not flinch. His eyes were on Nizar, ensuring he didn't go for the weapon in the Land Rover, ready to raise and fire the Kalashnikov if he made a move. Nizar turned from his dead asset back to Reese. A fear he had not known since his first firefights in Syria as a boy began to take hold.
"Where did that bullet come from?"
Slowly raising his hands, he fought for the words that might spare his life even as he resigned himself to his fate.
"I can be valuable to you, to your intelligence services."
Reese didn't acknowledge the offer, walking toward the man he had hunted across the globe.
"Think, Nizar."
"I am not the only one who wants you dead, Mr. Reese. I was on the helicopter with you in Africa. That local security man was aiming for you, not me."
Undeterred, Reese continued his approach.
"Why does everyone want you dead, Mr. Reese? The Russians, why do they want you dead?"
Reese pressed forward. All that mattered was putting Nizar in the ground.
"This was Freddy's team axe. He gave it to me right before you killed him."
"I will not beg for my life, Mr. Reese. You know I can offer your government information on organized crime syndicates in Montenegro, Russia, Europe, and the United States. Terrorist organizations, drug cartels, human trafficking syndicates."
"There is power in forgiveness,"
Reese heard Caroline Hastings' admonition in his head as he walked toward his target.
"What?"
Nizar said, puzzled. Reese paused for a moment. Freddy's words to him on the mountain were coming back to him.
"Forgive. Forgive Nizar. Forgive yourself. Live."
Nizar's eyes went to the Ventores. He lunged, catching a blur of movement as Reese closed the distance. Nizar felt the blade impact his shoulder, sending him stumbling partway into the driver's seat, and pain of flesh and bone giving way to Reese's wrath sent his body into instant shock. That recognition was followed by an unfamiliar heavy pressure across his stomach as the front spike of the tomahawk ripped across his abdomen. He was being disemboweled.
"I can reach it!"
His dive for the rifle was stopped short as Reese adjusted levels and tore the primal weapon across Nizar's upper right leg, slicing through the femoral artery and dropping the Syrian to his knees against the truck. Nizar slumped to the dirt, leaning against the faded green vehicle and watching the blood spurt from his leg, knowing that without a tourniquet he would be dead in minutes. He felt an odd sensation as he watched his intestines sliding from his stomach and mixing with the soil of his adopted land into the dark blood that was now pooling around him. He felt cold. It took all his effort to raise his head and look into the eyes of the specter of death who had come for him in the form of a sniper. A sniper who had outthought him by not playing the same game. As his strength waned, the evening clouds cast his executioner in a deep shadow. Nizar watched as Reese hit the pommel of his axe against his thigh, moving the weapon into a hammer grip, his breath coming in short gasps. He saw the American's lips move.
"What?"
Nizar whispered.
"I forgive you,"
Reese said. Confused, Nizar looked up in time to see the leading edge of the Sayok Hawk slice through the cold mountain air.
"No soul may die except with God's permission at a predestined time."
His final thought was of this Quranic teaching from his youth, the non-believer wondering if he was destined for Jannah or Jahannam, heaven or hell. The forward edge of the tomahawk impacted the center of Nizar's head and split his skull in two. He was dead before the blade came to rest, catching in the meat, sinew, and bone of his throat and spine. Reese paused for a moment, thinking of Joni and his words when she had met him on the tarmac at Andrews.
I'll find who did this, Joni. I'll find everyone responsible. I promise.
As Reese picked up his foot, placed it on Nizar's chest, and violently twisted the hawk to remove it from the bone and brain matter that held it fast, he heard Joni's response echo through his soul.
I know,
she had said. Reese wiped the blade on Nizar's body and sheathed it. It was done. The man who ensured that Freddy would never walk through the door to hold his wife and kids again, who left his widow to care for their special needs child, was dead.
First dig two graves.
Reese took the Vintores from the driver's seat, rocked the magazine out, and pressed down on the top round before reinserting it and performing a press check. He then walked to the dead body by the tree, took the AK, checked its status, removed the magazine, and put it in his pocket. He ejected the round from the chamber and pushed it into the magazine before flinging the weapon into the forest. Returning to the vehicle, he dragged Nizar's body into the tree line. Only then did he look to the hillside hide site 500 yards away and start his hike to where he had placed the man in the wheelchair with the Mohsin Nagant rifle 4 days earlier. Chapter 84. Gorky Park, Moscow, Russia. Mikhail Gromyko kept the Moskva River on his right as he worked his way deeper into Gorky Park, hands in his pockets to ward off the chill. The cold had not used to bother him this much. Maybe it was his aging bones.
Maybe it's the cancer.
The director of the SVR shook off thoughts of his mortality and turned up his collar. He had crossed the river from which the city took its name over the Pushkinsky pedestrian bridge using its open-air walkway, noting that the water that flowed through Moscow would eventually connect to the Volga and make its way to the Caspian Sea. He had been getting his exercise while practicing the tradecraft of his youth. The discipline to always plan and utilize surveillance detection routes was his responsibility as a professional. Never failing himself or a foreign asset by getting lazy is what had kept him alive. Perhaps Dashkov was right. Maybe it was time for him to get a protection detail. Enjoy the time he had left. The doctor was confident that he had years to live with the proper treatments. Receiving them in Moscow in secret was another matter. It might be time to leave the Russian capital for Switzerland and get his treatments on the shores of Lake Zurich. But he couldn't leave Moscow, could he? He had devoted his life to Mother Russia. Or had he devoted that life to power? Ah, Kissinger, he was right. Power is the ultimate aphrodisiac. Would he even be allowed to leave? He still had secrets locked away in his head, secrets that would make some, including Dashkov and the president, nervous. Gromyko peered across the path to a large amphitheater, empty tonight. His oval lenses had slid down the bridge of his nose and he adjusted his glasses for what seemed like the 100th time that evening. He would have to get a new set that would stay on his ever-thinning face. The park had another 30 minutes until it shut down for the night. The old spy knew its paths by heart. Nothing appeared out of place, even though it had been cleaned up and modernized in recent years, with the prostitutes, carnival rides, decrepit structures, and drug dealers, replaced by skateboarders, cafes, playgrounds, and museums. There remained dark corners where one could meet in private. The hunting lodge of Count Orlov, Trinity Church, and the Belaya Ladya Chess Club still graced its grounds, but so did trendy restaurants, a movie theater, and an ice rink. He did miss the days before the internet and algorithms, days when a clever intellect and gut instinct were what separated the great from the good, and oftentimes the great from the dead. They had not heard back from Nizar Katan. That was not entirely unusual or unexpected. The sniper had a reputation for strict adherence to operational security protocols, but Gromyko had expected to hear from the Frenchman. They had both gone dark. James Reese had not appeared on any facial recognition databases monitored by the Internet Research Agency, which was constantly scanning airports, train stations, and ports and traffic and security cameras. Reese's phone had been active in Osinje for a few days after his arrival. Geolocational tracking data collected by the Federal Protective Service's Special Communications and Information Service, better known as Spetsvias, indicated that Reese had stayed at the Hotel Palata Venezia for 4 days before driving north. He sent a text message to Victor Rodriguez at the CIA from just outside the village of Provalilla, at which point the signal had gone dark. Catan and Le Drian were already in position, waiting for their prey to enter the kill zone. Spetsvias was tasked with the collection and analysis of foreign communications and signals intelligence. It had once fallen under Dashkov's Federal Security Service, the FSB, and though it was now the purview of the FSO, the Federal Protective Service, the FSB director still maintained official and unofficial ties to what was the Russian version of the NSA. Gromyko veered off the Pushkinskaya embankment and took a trail into the heart of Gorky Park. There were sections that made one forget for a moment that they were in the middle of one of the largest and most populous cities on Earth. Dashkov had requested the meeting. He had beaten Gromyko to it. An in-person meeting away from the prying eyes and ears of their offices was in order. There may have been a development through the long electronic reach of Spetsvias. Was Reese alive or dead? If the SEAL had escaped Nizar's ambush in Montenegro, they would need to take more drastic measures, measures upon which Dashkov and the President would need to concur. Gromyko passed a semi-clothed statue of a ballerina and took a seat on a bench. Andreevsky Pond was visible through the trees. A light breeze cut the stillness of the night. No sign of Dashkov or his goons.
Dashkov, always with the games.
Apparently this time he had decided to make his old friend wait in the cold. No matter. Spying was a game of patience. Patience, trust, and creative problem-solving. Dashkov must have information that would shed light on what had happened in Montenegro. That information would dictate their next move.
Dashkov, where are you?
The SVR director reached into the pocket of his dark wool jacket and removed his pack of Marlboros and a plastic lighter.
This should warm these old bones.
In a long-practiced motion taught to him by his KGB instructors not far outside of Moscow, he tapped the pack and removed a cigarette, returning the pack to his pocket and striking the lighter with his thumb. The warm smoke filled his lungs as the nicotine was quickly absorbed by his blood and went to work stimulating neuron receptors and releasing the dopamine that activated the reward circuits in his brain. As the dopamine and endorphins hit, the spymaster leaned back on the bench. Gromyko was so absorbed in thought that he was not aware death had come for him until the long plastic zip tie was already over his head and around his neck. He heard the clicks of the teeth and shank engaging in the plastic head as the cable was pulled tight against his windpipe. He dropped his cigarette and his hands went to his throat, clawing at the thick plastic band that stopped just short of cutting off the supply of oxygen and blood to his brain. There is nothing quite so terrifying as suffocation. Even more terrifying is when that suffocation appears in the form of a ghost out of the night. Gromyko tried to twist away, but a powerful arm pushed him down and anchored his thin frame to the bench.
Relax. English.
Relax or I will pull back. The zip tie will cut off blood and oxygen to your brain and you will die.
American English. James Reese.
The SVR director stopped struggling and forced himself to take short breaths, barely enough oxygen making its way to his brain to keep him alive. The hand that anchored him to the bench left his shoulder and pointed down the trail. Gromyko caught it in his peripheral, then shifted his eyes before slightly canting his head.
Movement. What is that?
Between short gasps, he watched as a wheelchair emerged from the darkness. Gromyko watched in horror as the man he had put in the chair wheeled up to him, trapping the Russian's legs between the right wheel and the bench. The American's hand returned to his shoulder, his other still grasping the cable of the zip tie. One more pull and the plastic tie would cut all oxygen and blood from Gromyko's brain.
I've wanted to look you in the eye for 35 years, comrade.
Unable to speak, the Russian could only stare at Abelard.
I see the fear in your eyes, old man. Did you mean to kill me all those years ago?
Gromyko nodded, his eyes darting about, searching.
Tonight I return the favor, though I am going to succeed where you failed. Maybe Dashkov's security men will round the corner at any moment. Maybe there is still hope. What are you searching for, Comrade Gromyko? For your friend Dashkov? Did you think you were meeting him here? No. That was us. We set up this meeting.
Confusion flashed across the SVR man's face.
What? How?
Your Spetsvaz and your Internet Research Agency are easily fooled. Just as in the Cold War, the Americans have outplayed you. No one is coming.
Gromyko's hand went back to the plastic at his throat.
It's futile, Mikhail. Use these precious seconds you have left wisely. Are you wondering what happened to Oleg Bertsin?
How do they know so much?
No need to worry, you will see him soon. He no longer draws breath, but he told us something interesting before he died. He needed a favor, so in exchange, he told me who put me here,
Abelard said, gesturing to the wheelchair.
Which leads us to the question at hand. Why do you want James Rees dead?
Rees's left hand twisted the plastic tie just enough to let a little more air pass through, allowing Gromyko to answer the question.
I don't,
the Russian managed to rasp out.
It's no use lying, comrade. We know you have been trying to kill the man behind you for quite some time. I must say you have not done a particularly good job, as you can tell from your current predicament.
Think, Mikhail.
Now, why do you want him dead?
Gromyko thought of all the men he had seen die, all those he had ordered to their deaths. He thought of his training, his assignments, his ascension to the top of the Russian intelligence hierarchy. He thought of the long-term agents inserted deep into the heart of the West, the ones who had families, who had ushered in a second generation of deep penetration assets, behind enemy lines, infiltrating an entire society, poisoning it from within. He thought of the multi-generational plan to destroy the United States. And he thought of the man who had almost stopped it, Thomas Rees. There was nothing these two men could do.
Because of the list,
he whispered.
The list? Abelard asked. Explain.
Abelard lifted his eyes to look at Rees, who gave an almost imperceptible nod.
Ask him,
Gromyko said. Abelard looked back to the big man.
This is about the letter?
Rees asked.
Not a letter, a list.
What's on it? Rees asked. Gromyko shook his head.
Air,
the old man said. No, Rees said, you have enough to speak. Where's the list?
Smoke.
What? Rees asked.
Cigarette?
Rees looked at Abelard, who nodded. Keeping a hand on the back of the zip tie, Rees reached down from behind the bench into the Russian's coat pocket. He fished out a pack of cigarettes and a small lighter. He handed them to the old spy. Gromyko slowly tapped the pack against his shaking palm as he had done thousands of times over the preceding decades, but this time, just as he had been taught by his KGB instructors, he maneuvered a special cigarette into the rotation and pulled it out with cold, shaky fingers. He remembered his KGB cadre briefing his class on potassium cyanide. It had been exciting back in 1983. It was not so exciting now. As he pulled the Marlboro from the pack, he felt the filter to ensure it was the correct one. It was. The list, Rees said, getting impatient.
The list,
Gromyko repeated.
Your father made it. He didn't tell you where it was.
Rees stood silent at the mention of Thomas Rees.
No answer. I see he did not. At least I can go to my grave knowing those secrets died with him.
The Russian slowly inserted the cigarette between his lips, then shoved it into the back of his mouth and bit down. The L-pill embedded in the cigarette's filter broke apart before Abelard or Rhys could stop it. Rhys let go of the zip tie and pulled Gromyko's head back, trying to force his fingers into the man's mouth to dislodge the pill. The spy clamped his jaw shut and twisted his head back and forth in an effort to defend against the seal's attack. "How much time do we have?" Rhys asked, looking at Abelard.
"Probably cyanide. Not long. Minutes. It's over, James," Abelard said. "Let him die."
Rhys looked into the eyes of the man who held the secrets. They were already glazing over as the old man struggled to breathe, the cyanide blocking his frail body's ability to perform basic functions, the muscles of his diaphragm and heart losing their ability to circulate oxygen and blood. What his instructors outside of Moscow had failed to mention was that death by potassium cyanide poisoning is one of the most painful ways to leave the Earth. As the old spy thrashed about in agony, Rhys eyed the man in the wheelchair, who looked on without a hint of remorse. Rhys reached back to the zip tie, placed his hand at the head where the band passed through the claws, and gave a powerful tug, tightening the garrote and putting the old man out of his misery. Rhys glanced at the stainless steel watch on his wrist. The park would be closing soon. He then looked into the upturned eyes of the Russian spymaster.
"What secrets did you take to the grave?"
Rhys then hauled the smaller man over the back of the bench and carried him across a patch of grass and into the woodline. As the cerebral hypoxia shut down Mikhail Gromyko's brain, he had the vague sensation of floating. He realized he was being carried. His last thought before he drifted away was that James Rhys looked a lot like his father. Rhys threw the dead man unceremoniously into the shrubbery of the park that Gromyko had known so well, then returned to the man in the wheelchair. Rhys walked next to him back toward one of the main paths that paralleled the Moscow River.
"Facial recognition, identification, that should all be good. The technology department at the agency will take care of it," Rhys said, knowing full well that it wasn't the CIA or NSA, but an entity trapped in a maze of golden wires beneath Lackland Air Force Base. "Once we get home, I can't say. We are in uncharted territory."
"I'll take it from there," Abelard said.
"What are you going to do?" Rhys asked.
"I'll do what I always do," he said, gesturing to the wheelchair. "I'll adapt. But this time I might adapt back home."
"Home?"
"Israel."
Rhys smiled.
"And you?"
Abelard asked.
"What will you do?"
Rhys paused. They had reached a fork in the trail.
"I'm going to do the same."
To Abelard's questioning look, Rhys offered, "I'm going to adapt."
"Goodbye, Rhys,"
Abelard said, reaching up to shake the seal's hand before pushing off into the night.
"Goodbye,"
Rhys whispered after the bookseller had disappeared. He stood there a moment longer, allowing himself a brief moment to reflect. What of the list and his father's connection to Russian intelligence? Some things were best left to die in darkness. He thought of Katie and the mountains of Montana. It was time to go home. Their routes out of Moscow were cleared, their faces and identities electronically altered. No facial recognition technology would identify them at any point along their journey. Their passport aliases would be approved as valid. They were clean. As Rhys worked his way to the park exit, he looked up at a statue of a partially clad woman. She appeared to be dancing. He thought of the new woman in his life, the woman who had made the assassination of the director of Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service possible, a woman named Alice. Epilogue. Upon this, one has to remark that men ought either to be well-treated or crushed, because they can avenge themselves of lighter injuries, of more serious ones they cannot. Therefore, the injury that is to be done to a man ought to be of such a kind that one does not stand in fear of revenge. Niccolo Machiavelli, The Prince. Coomba Ranch, Flathead Valley, Montana. Rhys ran his fingers around the ring in the pocket of his jeans for around the 1,000th time that evening. Just ask her,
No, wait for the right time. Time. I'm so bad at this.
Reese's mind wandered to all that had come to light since his return from Russia. A senior Russian intelligence official with ties to the president had been found dead in Gorky Park a month earlier. According to Russian authorities, he had died of natural causes. He had been battling cancer for quite some time. Western news outlets noted that unusual numbers of both friends and enemies of the Russian president died of natural causes. A man with a beard had been captured on multiple cell phone videos running across a street in Turin, Italy, with an AK-type rifle. The videos were of varying quality and seemed to show him sprinting into a building across the street from a bookshop that had just been destroyed by a terrorist bomb. The explosive device had the hallmarks of an Islamic terror cell. It was the same type of IED that had been used in the July 7, 2005 attacks in London. It had been widely reported that a terror cell of Syrian refugees had targeted the rare book restoration business because its owner was Jewish. The beloved man in the wheelchair had not been seen since the attack. Speculation was that he had gone into hiding following the traumatic event. Some ventured that he might be in Israel. The bearded man had not been seen since the attack. The response to requests for information by news agencies to the CIA, FBI, Interpol, and the Italian intelligence services was that their investigations were ongoing and that anyone with information on the bearded man should contact their public tip hotlines. He remained a person of interest. A woman in Brindisi, Italy, had held out hope for her husband's return. She did not want to lose a second husband, especially one who was so kind to her and her children. That hope faded when 1.4 million euros appeared in her bank account. It came from a multinational investment fund that was financing small businesses across the globe. In this case, it was an investment in Italy's youth through a boxing gym. It was all perfectly legitimate. At least it appeared so in the event anyone came looking. That the money was withdrawn from multiple offshore accounts in Panama, Singapore, and Switzerland by a quantum computer beneath the runways of Lackland Air Force Base was known only to Reese and Alice. He flipped the ring around in his right pocket and looked at Katie. She was the one. "I've seen you run, but even you can't outrun time." Reese dug into his left pocket and felt the safe deposit box key. A final gift, or perhaps a curse, left to him by his father. He remembered finding the long-term storage facility that Tom Reese had arranged to receive recurring payments even after his death. In the back of the old Wagoneer parked in the storage bay was a case with an Ithaca Model 37 shotgun inside, the same weapon Tom Reese had used in the jungles of Vietnam. Behind the foam of the aluminum case were a key and letter addressed to James. They had no markings to indicate its origin, and the letter offered no clues as to the location of the safe deposit box to which it belonged. Not a day had passed since their discovery that Reese had not contemplated his father's words. Perhaps some secrets were best lost to history.
"I think it's time to let you go."
"James? James!"
"Huh?
What are you thinking about?"
Katie asked, a prying yet playful tone in her voice.
Time. I mean, nothing. I mean, the backstraps need to stay on it when they are on the birch barrel."
"James Reese, you are and have always been a horrible liar."
Katie smiled. She came around the island, locking her fingers behind Reese's head and pulling him to her lips.
"It's one of the things I love about you."
"Now I'm thinking we should just let dinner burn," Reese said, his eyes indicating the open door to the bedroom.
"You are going to have to wait. I'm famished," she teased. "Wine, dinner, then?"
Now it was Katie's turn to look to the bedroom.
"Well, I'm going to raise the coals out there and speed this process up," Reese said, his eyes taking in the woman before him.
"Deal,"
Katie replied.
"You are so beautiful."
"Flattery will get you everywhere,"
Katie said.
"What can I open?"
"Anything you'd like," Reese said, looking out past the deck to the expansive lake, smoke billowing from the grill.
"Let's start with white and then switch to a nice cab with dinner."
"That works," Reese said.
I liberated a couple bottles of Kistler from Jonathan's cellar a few days ago.
They make an exquisite Chardonnay.
That they do, Rhys said, moving toward the sliding glass door that opened onto the deck.
Just ask her. No, wait until after dinner. That's it. After dinner.
Katie walked to the attached garage where Rhys had installed the large standalone wine fridge that Jonathan had ordered.
If you are going to steal my wine, you bloody well better store it at the correct temperature, Jonathan had teased when it was delivered.
Katie knew he looked at Rhys like a son. With one daughter gone, it had been Rhys who had taken the life of her killer while at the same time saving Rafe's. Rhys was family. Katie poured two glasses of Kistler's finest and joined Rhys on the deck.
Cheers, Katie said.
To new beginnings? Rhys tried.
You really are bad at toasts, but you make up for it in other ways,
Katie smiled. To us?
Getting slightly better. To us,
Katie repeated. She turned to take in the view. A light breeze off the lake hit her face and she closed her eyes.
I could live here.
You could? What about D.C.? Work? Your own show?
It might be time for a change.
Rhys swallowed.
Should I ask her now? By the grill?
Katie,
James.
What?
I think dinner is burning.
Dang it!
Rhys raised the lid of the grill and quickly transferred the steaks to a waiting cutting board.
I raised the coals too high. I guess I was a bit distracted.
Get your head out of the gutter, mister.
That's a losing battle. Let's eat. Katie held the door as Rhys passed into the kitchen and set the board on the counter.
I think we got to them just in time, he said, gently probing the meat with his thumb.
Ah, disaster averted,
Katie concurred.
I took the liberty of decanting a bottle of Tuck Bextoffer Mockingbird Blue. I thought this would be a good night for it. We also received a box from War Paw Wines in Napa. I think it's a two-bottle night, so I went ahead and opened that, too.
Perfect, Rhys said, turning his attention to the salad. Potatoes have another 10 minutes in the oven, and then we'll be good to go. He turned back to Katie. She was staring at him, her deep blue eyes probing, curious, with a hint of mystery.
James, are you really done with the CIA?
Rhys turned on the faucet, the warm water seeping between his fingers. He dried his hands on a dish towel and tossed it to the side before answering. He thought of the letter from his father, a letter and a key.
Perhaps some things are better left buried.
I'm done, Katie. Freddy's killer is dead. The same guy who killed Aaliyah. All those who killed Lauren and Lucy, my SEAL troop, the man who ordered the assassination of my father, all dead. It's time to move on. Time for a new chapter. It's time to live here in the present. Nothing has ever been more clear to me.
And what did Vic and the president say when you told them you'd be officially retiring?
The president was all for it. He thanked me for my service and told me to call him if I ever needed anything.
That's a good favor to have in the bank. You did save him from having to wipe 2 U.S. cities off the map a year ago, after all.
There is that, Rhys said, as he remembered leveling the Tabuk Kalashnikov at Iranian General Jafar al-Sadiq's head, pressing the trigger and then leaving the president's fiancée's ring in the dead general's hand.
Though you are going to have a hard time getting in touch with him without a cell phone or a computer.
Maybe that's the point, Rhys ventured, taking another sip of the chilled Chardonnay. This is great, by the way.
That it is,
Katie confirmed.
And Vic?
Vic just said, we'll see.
Ah, he knows you too well.
Not well enough, Rhys said, putting down his wine glass. He took Katie's from her hand and set it on the counter. Then, without another word, he swept her off her feet and carried her to the bedroom. The snipers had been dropped off on an adjoining property and had double-timed it to their positions above the cabin at the edge of the lake. National-level intelligence well beyond their pay grade had confirmed that the robust security measures employed on the property had been disabled. A satellite and drone provided real-time imagery to their Getac tactical tablets. They took up positions on the hillside, one team covering the driveway and entrance and the other covering the back porch and dock. Alpha 1-4 has eyes on. Roger that, Alpha Team. Charlie 1-6 is in position. Good copy, Charlie Team. The spotter from Alpha Team typed a salute report into his tablet and pressed send. Katie had never seen him so at peace. Though he was still never out of arm's reach of a pistol, she had noticed a shift as they hiked and talked. The eyes that had always scanned seemed more focused on her rather than on threats from the unknown. For the first time, she felt that he was not 1,000 miles away on a distant battlefield or fighting the internal demons that were a consequence of a life at war. He was present. He was with her, in the moment. She sensed that he was feeling a freedom he had never known.
"Well, Mr. Rees,"
Katie said, putting on her reporter's hat as they sat down to enjoy the now cold, sliced venison backstraps.
"Now I really am starving."
"That was all part of my plan," Rees said. "I needed you to be hungry enough that you wouldn't notice how much I overcooked these."
"Mission success," Katie confirmed. "What are you thinking?"
"I'm thinking I need to work on my flexibility," he said mischievously.
"Mr. Rees,"
Katie said, pointing her steak knife in his direction across the table, a gleam in her eyes. "Just kidding. Though that may be true, I'm thinking about us."
"Oh, do tell, what about us?"
Katie probed. "Does she know?" I don't know. Just about life. The future," Rees said, slicing off a bite of venison.
"I am not the only one who wants you dead, Mr. Rees. I was on the helicopter with you in Africa. That local security man was aiming for you, not me."
"Not now, Rees. Be present."
"Well, let's start there,"
Katie said, guiding him along and pouring more deep red liquid into his glass.
"Without the CIA or running around the world at the behest of the president, what do you want to do with this next chapter?"
"I don't know."
"That I am not buying for a second."
"Okay, I have a thought or two."
"Well?"
"Well, I was thinking of sticking around for a while."
"Oh, you were you? Not zipping off to parts unknown to battle the forces of evil?"
"I'm thinking it's time to pass the torch."
"Your beard isn't getting any less gray," Katie teased again.
"Besides," Rees continued, "we've hardly put a dent in Jonathan's wine cellar, and I get the sneaking suspicion that Rafe has taken to hiding some of the more interesting and expensive bottles, which poses a challenge."
"You are not one to back down from a challenge."
"This is true. Besides, I'm just getting started luring Rafe into competitions for which I've spent months preparing and setting the conditions. I'm thinking a lever-action rifle and revolver challenge next. Just need to walk him into it, make it his idea." Katie rolled her eyes.
"And for employment?"
"Well, as part of the deal in tracking down Mo a few years back, the Navy included a retirement package."
"Ah, the big bucks," Katie said, taking a sip of wine.
"Yeah, it's not much, but it's something, and I..."
"What, James?"
"Well, I thought I could guide some hunts with Rafe. You could help me improve my fly fishing."
"You do need all the help you can get on that front."
"And should I ask her now?"
"And what?"
"I thought of starting a business."
"Oh, James, an entrepreneur. That's kind of a turn-on."
"I was hoping you'd say that."
"Continue."
"Well, a couple things, actually. The owner of Glacier Archery is getting ready to retire. He's mentioned it to me a few times now. I think he's testing the waters. Rafe and I might buy it." Katie put down her fork.
"James, I kind of thought you were kidding. Are you sure? A new chapter?"
"A new chapter. I've always loved local archery shops. Archery is so beneficial for veterans. I think we hire prior military, train them up, connect it with Rafe's hunting program. A one-stop shop to get people in the right bow, putting in the reps, and then get them out in these mountains after elk and muleys."
"Rafe with customer service?"
"I'd keep him as an investor. Not sure I'd even allow him in the store."
"That's a wise first decision. You might just have a knack for this."
"And ask her."
"And?"
"And I thought of opening a coffee shop and bookstore in Whitefish. Locally roasted coffee, old, hard-to-find, and restored books."
"Rees, really?"
The hope was evident in her voice. "I'm thinking about it. Maybe spice it up a bit with archery, a bookstore, coffee house, and whiskey bar highlighting veteran-owned whiskeys. There are quite a few out there these days. Katie took Reese's hand across the table. Was there hope for them? Hope for a future with Reese, devoid of the killing that had permeated their lives since they had first met?
I love it. What would you call it?
Reese's Relics? Reese shook his head. That sounds like an antique store or a salvage yard.
I can tell you have an idea.
I was thinking about Abelard's.
Abelard's?
Katie asked. Yep.
I think I've heard that name in the news recently.
It was the name of a guy I knew once. He helped me when I needed it.
Abelard's,
Katie said, contemplating the name. Yep. Abelard's Books, Coffee, and Whiskey.
That's quite a combination. I love it.
All my favorite things in one place.
All your favorite things?
Katie said, smiling. Well, most of them. And I, do it.
You what?
I, thought it might be a good place for our kids to work in high school. Katie's eyes misted over. She bit her quivering lip and in a voice tinged with emotion asked,
James, are you serious?
Do it. Reese took Katie's hands in his. Katie, I've never been more serious or sure about anything. I'm done with the agency. I'm done with the government. If you'll have me, I want to spend the rest of my life making you the happiest woman on earth. Katie was in a state of shock. There was nowhere she would have rather been. Reese stood up, reached into his pocket, and then took a knee. Katie Baranek. Reese swallowed. A sound disturbed the moment. At first, it didn't register. It was Katie's ringtone. They didn't have cell service at the cabin. An alarm? Katie's purse was on the couch.
Oh, my God, I am so sorry. I swear I'm going to throw that thing in the lake.
You'll have to beat me to it, Reese said. The ringtone was louder than Reese remembered. Katie stood and went to the couch, fishing out her phone and thinking she would just turn off the alarm. But it wasn't an alarm. It was a phone call.
That's weird.
What is it? Reese asked.
It's a phone call from Alice? I don't think I know an Alice.
Reese stood, turning all business in less than a second. He walked to Katie. Let me see it. It now read, missed call.
James, I don't have cell service here, and you dismantled the internet.
Reese was about to press on the missed call when the phone chirped again with a message received. Reese hit the text message icon.
Turn on the radio.
Reese's head rotated to the radio they used to communicate on the ranch. Repeaters were set up at high points so that Jonathan could connect with them at remote locations around the property.
James?
He handed Katie her phone, walked to the radio, and turned it on. He had turned it off before dinner, wanting nothing to disturb them. Reese twisted the dial to turn up the volume. What he heard over the speaker turned his blood to ice. It was Rafe, and he said only one word.
Avalanche.
Reese's head snapped toward the door and then to the rifle in the corner next to his body armor. It wasn't Rafe's voice he heard next. It was Jonathan Hastings. The Rhodesian accent was level and unmistakable. Reese had not heard that tone since they had linked up in Kamchatka, Russia, where Reese had delivered the news that Jonathan's daughter was dead.
Son, I want you to listen to me. If you never listen to another bloody thing I say, stand down. The sheriff is here along with some serious boys from HRT. They don't want a fight, but by God, they are ready for one. I told them I could talk you out. I promised them you would come out without a fight. I'm not going to lose you, son.
The radio was set up on a desk near a window facing the driveway. Reese pushed aside the curtain, seeing a caravan of headlights headed toward the cabin.
Come out, lad. No weapons. Hands high. Just do what they say. This is not the time to fight. Trust me. You know I'd shoot straight with you, and you know I'd pick up a rifle if I thought that was the call. It's not.
Reese said nothing. He was counting the vehicles.
Reese, confirm you receive this, and that you are standing down. I promise you we will get you the best lawyers.
James, what's happening?
Katie asked, panic creeping into her voice.
It's all over the news, Reese, Jonathan said. Turn on the TV, son.
Reese set the handset down, and instead of turning on the television, he went to the AR by the door and confirmed there was a round chambered and that it had a full magazine. Katie, put on your body armor and go lie down in the bedroom, he said, sliding an arm through his plate carrier and pulling it into place over his head.
I'll do no such thing, not until you tell me what's happening.
Rhys, it was Jonathan's voice on the radio. Are you there? Rhys. Rhys looked at the radio and then picked up a remote control and hit the power button. The TV was already set to a cable news channel. The banner read, Chaos in the Capital, President Assassinated. Just 35 minutes ago, shots were fired at President Alex Christensen by a member of the armed forces during a Veterans Day parade in the nation's capital. A video went to troops in formation marching down Pennsylvania Avenue, the president standing with his vice president and cabinet on a platform to observe the parade. A soldier stepped from the line, raised his rifle at the president, and pressed the trigger. The bullets impacted the glass barrier protecting the commander-in-chief, the thick plastic absorbing the bullets. The president's and vice president's protection details throwing them to the deck as the shooter took a round to the chest from what Rhys knew was a sniper, just seconds before his head exploded from a shot that was probably fired by an undercover Secret Service agent in the crowd. Chaos. The troops, police, Secret Service, the crowd all descending into turmoil as the president and vice president were rushed to waiting vehicles to usher them to safety. Rhys and Katie watched in disbelief as the camera switched to more grainy footage from a street surveillance camera. The president's limo and Secret Service Suburbans rocketed through Washington for a secure location. Then the screen turned to dust. Our security analysts confirm that the president's motorcade was hit with what we are being told were chain-linked EFPs, explosively formed penetrators, improvised explosive devices that came to prominence during the war in Iraq. The president was rushed to George Washington University Hospital, where he was pronounced dead. The vice president has taken the oath of office and will address the nation at the top of the hour, some 8 minutes from now.
James,
Katie said, looking up at him, the horror apparent in her eyes. Rhys shifted his focus from the screen to Katie and then to the rifle in his hands. The line of black Suburbans were close now. He heard a helo overhead, and then a second off the dock at the back of the cabin hovering over the moonlit water. James Rhys, you are surrounded by federal and local law enforcement, came a voice from one of the Suburbans. Come to the front of the house, unarmed. If you surrender peacefully, you will not be harmed. Rhys knew there would be snipers in the woods in elevated positions and snipers on each helicopter. He looked at the rifle again, then to Katie. I love you, Katie.
James.
He set the rifle on the ground, then drew his pistol from its holster on his belt, then putting it on the table. He then removed his plate carrier. He leaned down, looked Katie in the eyes, and kissed her.
Hold on to this for me, he said, pressing a diamond engagement ring into her hand. And this.
Katie looked down and saw a safe deposit box key. Before she could utter a word, Rhys pulled off his shirt and went to the door. I'm coming out. I'm unarmed, he shouted. Open the door, slowly, and show us your hands. Opening the door, he shouted through the crack. Rhys stepped to the porch. Keep your hands high, Commander. Slowly turn around. Rhys did as he was told, turning in a slow 360 to confirm that he had no weapons and was not strapped with a suicide vest. Walk down the steps and go prone. Rhys obeyed, taking in the army of heavily armed federal agents who had him in their sights. Cross your legs, arms out to your sides. Turn your head. Rhys did as he was instructed. He heard the rush of feet in the gravel driveway as agents converged. A team blew past and up the steps into the cabin, and he could hear Katie demanding to see a warrant. He felt his right arm and then his left wrenched behind his back, plastic zip ties securing his wrists. An agent frisked his ankles up to his crotch and then belt line, removing his belt in the process. He was ordered to roll to his left and get to his feet as they assisted him. Barefoot, in jeans and no shirt, Rhys scanned the front driveway. It looked like every law enforcement agent in the western United States was in his front yard. Jonathan and Caroline stood by a Suburban with Rafe by their side. Rafe had the look of a predator ready to start ripping heads from bodies. It didn't escape notice that he had four agents on him just in case. A man and a woman approached, both wearing jeans and dark blue FBI windbreakers. Rhys knew what they were going to say before they opened their mouths.
James Reese, I'm Special Agent in Charge Jim Klein, and this is Special Agent Catherine Edwards from the Salt Lake Field Office. You are under arrest for conspiracy to assassinate the President of the United States. Flanked by heavily armed agents, two of the larger ones grabbed his arms and ushered him toward a vehicle waiting with the rear passenger door open, an agent already in the far seat. Reese locked eyes with Caroline, Jonathan, and then Rafe, holding their gaze as long as he could, before his head was pushed down and he was moved into the center seat, one of his escorts sliding in next to him while the other closed the door. Reese's thoughts were not on the agents to his right and left, not on the president or the country, not on Katie, the Hastings family, or a future that had just been ripped away from him. His thoughts were on a letter from the grave. Author's note. It takes skill to kill with a rifle. It takes something else to outmaneuver and outthink your adversary. To do that, you must know your capabilities and limitations and those of your enemy. That means study and immersion. As Sun Tzu wrote in Chapter 3, Attack Stratagems of the Art of War, if you know the enemy and know yourself, you need not fear the result of 100 battles. The mind remains the most capable and lethal of weapons. As with my previous novels, In the Blood is a work of fiction. That fiction is informed by whispers of truth. The HVT bar in Baghdad's Green Zone did exist and did play a role in building trust among a CIA-led team of intelligence officers, paramilitary contractors, and a select few active-duty military special operators. I still have my shot glass. It was an honor. Those familiar with Kibbutz Merom Golan will know I took some artistic license. For security reasons, I did not describe the actual level of preparedness in that community. What I will say is that if a team of terrorists were to infiltrate Merom Golan the way I portray, they would not be long for this world. The Soviet Mi-24 Hind helicopters did indeed dominate the skies over Afghanistan up until September 26, 1986, when three were shot down in a single afternoon with American Stinger missiles. The Borgodora enclave of the Aurora district of Turin is as depicted, save for the royal green awning with Abelard's Libri Rari e Restauro inscribed on its valence. If such a business did exist, the owner may very well have a curriculum vitae that included the Central Institute for the Conservation and Restoration of Damaged Books in Rome, an internship at Giulio Giannini e Figlio in Florence, and time with Conti Borboni in Milan. It is unknown whether the purveyor of said fictitious establishment would have a hidden safe stocked with weapons and history as an assassin for the Mossad. The bombs used by the Syrian terrorists do bear the hallmarks of the homemade explosive devices used in the July 7, 2005 bombings in London. Though more specific instructions are readily available online, I chose to leave some of the particulars out of this manuscript. The history of the CIA's MKUltra project and Sidney Gottlieb's involvement is accurate, based on sworn testimony before the Church Committee in 1975, and declassified records that survived destruction ordered by the CIA director in 1973. As with the biomedical research I did while writing The Devil's Hand, I had no touch point with quantum computing, cyber warfare, internet levels, artificial intelligence, mass data storage, or NSA surveillance of American citizens during my time in the military. That meant I needed to dig. Much as with the bioweapons research, officially called biodefense research by the United States government, which I did for my previous novel, I went deep down the rabbit hole into the world of cyber warfare and quantum computing for In the Blood. Through books, journal articles, and personal interviews, I was able to piece together the facility and capabilities described in these pages. Those capabilities were toned down to keep this book out of the science fiction section. Is Alice real? The best way to answer that is to wish her a good day. There is no doubt she is watching me as I type this right now.
In the Blood was written by Jack Carr and read by Ray Porter. Editing, mix, and post-production by Like 2,000 Pounds. The associate producer was Anna Chan. In the Blood was produced and directed by Travis Tun. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. In the Blood is available in print from Atria, Emily Bestler Books. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, The Devil's Hand, written by Jack Carr and read by Ray Porter.